We hear a lot of perspectives on the Mankind podcast. Inclusion of a guest is not an endorsement of their views, and the opinions expressed here do not always represent the mission or values of the Mankind Project USA.
Looks like the rain has gone.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back. It's Boys and Hodgson on the Mankind Podcast, the podcast where we're setting out to prove that there is indeed more than one way to be a man. And we are doing it just a fine job of it, I think. So today I'm with Sean Harvey, and we'll talk about a little bit of our history together as we get in. But first, just say hello, Sean.
Hey, everybody. Boys, it's great to be here, and thanks for inviting me.
I am so stoked to be in this conversation. So Sean and I have known each other for some time, and we were kind of bouncing off of each other in different environments. And we know all this. Sean is one of those guys. He's one of those guys where you say, hey, do you know this book by so-and-so? And he'll, oh, yeah. Hey, do you know this person? Oh, yeah. I spent some time with them back and blah, blah, blah. He's one of those guys who just kind of knows everybody and has done a bunch of stuff. So we're going to get into that. And he is also an author, and his book, Warrior Compassion, Unleashing the Healing Power of Men, will be coming out very soon. I've had the opportunity to read an early copy of the book. It's really good. So we're going to spend some time talking today about men's healing work, men's healing journeys, shadow work, the long and winding road that brought Sean into being the man that he is, with all of the aspects of who he is integrated into this one powerful facilitator man. And we're going to talk about going men's work in spaces where it feels really hard to do men's work, as we know it here on the podcast, and you've been hearing about it. So, Sean, MSOD. What's MSOD?
Master of Science in Organization Development.
And then MSED is Master of Science in Education. He is the Chief Compassion Officer and founder of Warrior Compassion Men's Studio. His work in personal organization and societal transformation is inspired by 25 years of organizational development and consulting, combined with his past and current academic affiliations at Cornell, NYU, Baruch College, SUNY. George Washington University. In 2021, Sean received the Saul Silverman Award for Conflict Resolution and Healing from the International Organizational Development Association for Healing Work with Men in Hypermasculine Systems. Bookmark that. We're going to come back to it. As an interfaith minister, he co-founded Project Compassion, a national initiative to deepen compassion in police departments. Sean is also a TEDx speaker with his talk, Compassion Makes the Warrior. I'll reference his website multiple times in here, but warriorcompassion.com. So, Sean, first of all, we're going to go backwards a little bit. And the first time that you and I met was at a film screening in New York City, in Midtown, for The Masculivin? Is that what the screening was? What movie was it?
It was. It was The Masculivin, yeah.
And it was one of those events where there were some very cool, Ehrman was there, and a bunch of cool folks were in the crowd, and Sean and I just ended up over off to one side, introduced ourselves to each other, and then like within 5 minutes, it was like deep into men's healing work conversation. What do you remember about that?
I actually the point I remember vividly is seeing you at Ray Arada's Better Man Conference,
right,
in New York. But going back, a few events, yeah, because I remember I met you, Jennifer Brown. I kind of met many of the folks who are, I think Jackson Katz was there, or or I remember someone who was involved in football doing this with athletes.
Yep.
And it was really my entree into meeting other men doing men's work. So it was, it's kind of like overwhelm. I remember just being overwhelmed in that experience, but our conversation, we went deep quickly. So I do remember that.
And so we'll start kind of in the history part. I think that at that time you may have still been with Eileen Fisher. Mm-hmm. So, okay, Eileen Fisher, global, international, high-end, gorgeous women's clothing brand. Uh-huh. How does men's work fit into Eileen Fisher? Tell us some of that story.
You know, I prior to starting at Eileen Fisher, I was a consultant on Wall Street in New York. I was a college professor. And on my 40th birthday, I gave it all up and walked into my CEO's office and said, you know, I've lost my heart and my soul in the job, and I resigned. And it was my birthday present to me. And within 2 weeks, a friend of mine said, hey, we're hiring at Eileen Fisher. Do you know anyone that's interested? And I said, you know, I'm here. I didn't really know much about what I was getting into. I didn't know anything about the company beyond they were doing some cool, innovative things. So I applied, went on an 8-month interview process. And on my first day, I think this was the conversation that changed the trajectory of my life. You know, my two bosses sat me down and they said, so Sean, we just want to acknowledge that you have proven yourself in the interview process. We now want you to stop proving yourself and learn how to be who you actually are. When you interviewed with us, you showed us your heart and you showed us your polish. We hired you for your heart and we want to see less of your polish. We want to see you unfiltered. And, you know, I didn't really know what to say, but again, where do you hear this in a corporate setting? So I was the internal change agent for creative and then ultimately became the head of personal transformation and well-being for the company. And what I noticed, so the company really was built on feminine leadership, and it was a feminine energy business model that really valued simplicity or the intuition, an organic approach and full creativity and compassion. And that embodied the entire culture. And what I noticed over my time there was that everybody was being transformed, but men in particular were being transformed in the culture. And often it would be these informal chats that I'd have with other men, and I would say, hey, I feel like I'm changing. Are you changing? And they're like, yeah, you know, well. And it would always go something like this. You know, my wife said, I listen differently, or I'm more patient. I stopped needing to be right all the time, and I started to be more curious. I am expressing more of my emotion. I have more full range of my emotions. I'm tapping into my creativity and solving problems differently. But what was across the board, every man said, but I really feel more comfortable in my own skin because the culture allows me to be who I really am. And so I don't think Eileen Fisher ever set out to be this organization supporting men's healing. But I think because of what it was and what it was doing, the culture it had created, men were organically just being transformed. Like not even realizing it until they noticed, or someone noticed in them that they were different. And I said, I think we need to bring this out to more men. And I remember when I met you and other men in men's work, and I'd always joke, and I would say, you know, I did my men's work through the feminine because I did it through Eileen Fisher's culture. And we still are ending up in a similar place. So I also think it's important to know that there are many pathways to this place of integration, this place of awakening, this place of personal growth that gets us into a different inner alignment with ourselves and the world.
Nice. So you talked about a feminine culture. So let's go a little bit more into that, just because you and I talk in symbols, you have so much learning and wisdom about the world of the symbolic, mm-hmm. right? And so feminine culture, Eileen Fisher, juxtapose that. So let's talk about masculine culture and recognize that we're talking in archetypes and symbols and metaphor and, yeah.
Well, you know, as I was going through my experience at Eileen Fisher, I was very cognizant of going from Wall Street to Eileen Fisher, from hyper-masculine environment to hyper-feminine environment. Just how radically different. It's sort of like everything I'd learned about organizations was turned on its head. I think I think it was summed up well. A couple of us co-authored an article for the Journal of Management, Spirituality, and Religion called "Nurturing the Soul of the Company" at Eileen Fisher, looking at the soul of the company. And when we asked employees, how do you define the soul of this company? And the majority of the answers were, well, it starts with Eileen. And what struck me was they said she values the deep intuitive knowing more than empirically based data and research. And so that was the first piece where I noticed, to follow the intuition, to trust the intuition at such a level that she turned $350 into a $500 million company without being focused on the metrics that are traditional in most organizations. That was first and foremost. I think second, you know, we did wild things. I mean, we would meditate at the beginning of every meeting. You know, I was sent to an artist commune in Canada for 5 months to learn how to incorporate the arts into creative facilitation. I had a number of different wild experiences there. But I think what was most profound was the focus on human first, professional second. And that we focus on the personal growth and transformation of our employees first, because good humans do good work. You know? And that was really Eileen's premise, that if we do our inner work first, we're going to perform better. So let's focus on the inner work rather than focus on the outcomes. And then there was a genuine care. There was a genuine care and a freedom to just be who you were no matter what. And then it was such a learning culture that perfectionism. Eileen had a mantra of perfect enough to get people out of analysis paralysis from this place of perfectionism. And so I think the way the culture was set up that was based on compassion and generosity, really understanding what it means to tap into your full creativity and to ensure that all voices, regardless of hierarchy, can be heard. With respect, and there was a humanity in the culture, I think also demonstrated by the commitment to women and girls, the environment, and social impact, that the organization was really walking its own talk. And what I found from my other experiences, I think the need to be right and get it right, not having the room for emotional expression, not valuing creativity and play, being serious all the time, and being driven to strive to perform, to strive to achieve, and to strive to move up. And I think what's lost in that is our humanity. And so for me, the juxtaposition of the two was, where could I be and experience my full humanity versus where was I stripped down to my constructed identity?
So if I were characterizing the kind of feminine symbolism versus masculine symbolism out of what you said, like where I come is the masculine has a hierarchy of importance, a kind of one way attitude. Like we're going forward, we're going to do it the right way. Metric first. What can we measure? What the things, the thing focus?
Or prove it to me.
Intellect over intuition. Right? Because you're a smart guy, and that the first thing that you were asked to kind of, I want to see more of who you are, more heart, less polish. Yes. And the kind of not compartmentalized. So there's some beautiful stuff and some valuable stuff in our human ability. And again, this is not men, women, right? In our human ability to compartmentalize things when we need to compartmentalize things. But how, where in like, where in the world are we compartmentalizing way too much that's preventing us from being more creative, being more human, being more fully. Yeah.
What I always say, and when I left the organization, when I left Eileen Fisher, I kept asking the question, you know, one, as I said, what if more men could be exposed to what we were exposed to? There were 200 of us out of 1,200 employees. So that also created a very different understanding of the role men play and the role men can play when it's a female-dominated environment. Second, what if we were to build bridges across gender in a way that, not to de-emphasize equity, but to really emphasize innovation, to solve problems differently? And then third, what if our organizational systems took the best of the masculine and the best of the feminine and brought them into a new type of integrated model? So none of this is ever that we diminish the masculine or that we elevate the feminine in isolation, but that we come into a different type of integration that allows for a fuller experience of our humanity. So I think what happens in these conversations is we can demonize the masculine, overemphasize the feminine, or realize, and I, as I often say, especially in these hyper-masculine environments, there is a distorted view of the masculine and an anemic view of the feminine.
Nice. Say more.
But it's just taking us out of the reality of the full axis of men and their capacity to be human.
Nice. Really, really good stuff in there. So Eileen Fisher, all of this transformational work, you developed and led so much, facilitated so much work in that environment, got so many inputs in that environment. And then what?
That article that I mentioned.
Yeah.
You know, we were surrounded by so many spiritual guides in the organization, and just tapping into spirituality in the workplace wasn't out of bounds in that culture. So we had Akashic Records readers, we had medical intuitives, we had astrologers, we had acupuncturists, we had a very holistic view of well-being for all employees that merged into and blended into the spiritual. I experienced some of it when I was at the artist commune. I was experiencing it in so many different small ways. And when I realized that I was being called to work with men, and as I tell you and I tell so many men who lead men's work, if we're in leading men's work for the long haul, I don't think there's any of us who chose to do this. I think it chooses us, and it really is a calling. That becomes very difficult to not heed the call.
Yeah.
And even when we try, or no matter how hard it gets, because it's so needed today, especially. But when I first heard the call, there's the last thing in the world I want to do was work with men. Like, I had left Wall Street and went to this women's fashion company because I'm like, I'm more comfortable in this space with women. I'm more comfortable in this culture.
Yeah.
And so I knew it was beyond my pay grade, and I knew that it was a spiritual calling. And I also am, you know, I'm a systems thinker and organization development practitioner first and foremost.
Yeah.
And so when I look at the systems that are crumbling around us, the oppressive systems that are crumbling around us, they don't need to be rebuilt on outdated models. They need to be reimagined with a fresh approach and from a place of deeper consciousness and collective wisdom. To get to that place, when you work backwards, when I work backwards, I see men in power who are wounded, holding on to power out of fear. And that is the place to do the work. And if we can do the work of providing healing, not changing, not fixing, but healing for these men, that can transform the whole way you see yourself, the whole way you lead, and the whole way you think about organizational systems. That can come from a place of deeper humanity, come from a place of deeper consciousness, and we can reimagine our organizational societal systems differently. And so I knew to be able to do that work, this was not a psychological approach. This was a psycho-spiritual approach that was required, and that's what led me to seminary to become an interfaith minister for the sole purpose of understanding and figure out a way or receiving the way to engage men around soul healing work that then can become a catalyst for systems change.
That's great. You circled back around for the sole purpose, you said, and I thought S-O-L-E, S-O-U-L.
Yes.
For the soul's purpose of, yes, doing this healing work that you're doing. So I'm going to back up because, so practitioners talking to practitioners here a little bit.
Yeah.
Right. The call, hearing the call, responding to the call, refusing the call. I've come to view you as an expert in somebody who hears and understands and responds to calls. Mm-hmm. So for all of those other practitioners out there, like, so audience, like, yo, listen to this. This guy has turned his entire life on a dime multiple times because he's heard a call. Like, fearlessly turning your whole life upside down, moving cities multiple times, going to intense levels of commitment to get the education and get the experience that you've gotten. I view you as an expert in hearing intuitive calls and responding to them. What do you have to say to other people out there who are listening to that fucking red phone ringing and refusing it?
From my experience, when you hear the call and you refuse the call, your life will become exponentially harder until you get on the path of the call. And to do the work of the inner alignment to then be able to support what you're being called to do. So when I think about purpose, when I think about mission, I kind of break it down in three ways. There's our job and career mission and purpose that that's what we often think about when we think about our purpose, right? What do I do? What am I supposed to do? Then there's your life purpose. So what am I meant to do as a human on earth? And then there's our soul purpose. What is that purpose that we contracted with the divine to come into this lifetime to learn, to grow, and to contribute into the world in this life that we have? That may have nothing to do with our career or what we've fallen into. That's what I'm talking about. That level of soul's call. When you become quiet enough, or when you listen to the nudges from the universe, it's giving you the pathway, and it's waiting for you to say yes. And so I, you know, the first time I followed the call, I was 16 years old. I just come out as a gay man at 15. And my mom was very supportive, you know, when you read the book, you'll know my dad was not so supportive.
So much.
Right? And I was a precocious 15-year-old, and at 16, I saw this gay activist in the Dayton Daily News. I'm from Dayton, Ohio. Who, like, did this activist, I can't remember, it was like over 30 years ago, but did this, he led a protest or something of that nature, Jim McCarthy. And so I picked up the phone and called him and said, hey, I want to volunteer in the gay community. And he said, well, what do you want to do? And I'm like, I want to work with gay youth. I want to support gay youth in coming out. And he said, well, there's nothing like that exists. And I'm like, well, I think there should be. It's kind of how I operate. And he said, well, if you want to leave this, we'll give you the support, the financial and space to start creating this. And with that, within like a month, I created Youth Quest, the first gay and lesbian youth group for the city of Dayton, Ohio.
This is not in the book. This story is not in the book, folks.
And so it's the organization still exists today, and it now serves all of Southwest Ohio. And I was creating vision and mission statements at 16. I didn't even know what they were. I just was instinctively developing what I thought I needed to create a structure and a viable organization. Now it serves 80 youth at any one time. And every time I've made a decision in my life, If I've chosen money, status, or title, I fell on my face within 6 months. If I would sit in silence and go back to that first experience at 16, that always gave me the intuitive knowing of what's next. So by the time I applied to Eileen Fisher, I gave up my life at 40, decided I couldn't do this anymore. Eileen Fisher opened up. I said yes. There was a knowing throughout that process that I had to take this job. I didn't understand why. And my boss would often say, one of my bosses would often say, you're here for a reason and it's not this job. And you'll find out in time what that reason is. And that's pretty much, like, the universe is always giving us clues as to what our call is. Question is, how quiet are we becoming to listen, and how are we paying attention, and how much courage do we have? And I think that comes from the inner strength and resilience. And now, as a queer progressive New Yorker who works with men in hypermasculine spaces and who works with white nationalists and extremists, you know, folks who could kill me just for who I am. And to have had, because the journey is not easy. The journey is going to test you to build the muscles you need to hold what you are meant to hold. So by the time that I got to the point of realizing who my target audience is, men who are suffering in silence, who are operating from either a mindset or in a system that is hypermasculine, that is devoid of the feminine and fear of the feminine, I was ready. I said, you know, I could get killed for this. And I said, and this is a cause worth dying. Mm. I think that was the commitment to this work and to helping men who are suffering, giving them the invitation into their healing so we can start healing the world.
I'm just like letting that sit with everybody for a minute. It seems like the men in these hyper-masculine cultures, right? So this idea of compartmentalization or being placed in a box seems to be popping up for me in this conversation. And the thing for a lot of us who are socially enculturated into this idea, framework, whatever, of the masculine in today's capitalist, consumerist, like in the systems that we're in, like what's in the box is our souls.
Right.
And So tell me about, because I'm making a leap here, tell me about seeing a man's soul in one of those spaces.
Well, my boyfriend is a Republican, and so I get firsthand experience at seeing someone who's very different than me and who sees the world very different than me. And he's taught me a lot. He's taught me a lot, you know. When people ask me how I can do what I do, you know, I think first and foremost is I've done enough work on myself to be able to see the humanity in each man I experience. And that to realize that our political affiliation is not our definition. To understand that if I have views that are different from others, that is not my total definition. And that we are complex beings. And I look for and can see the humanity in that person, how he loves his family, how he loves his community, what he is, where he has pride and where he has fear. Right? And how he contributes in the world. And what I find with so many of these men is where they're feeling overlooked or where they're feeling lost or where they're feeling have a fear of becoming irrelevant. Right? And so that lost, I often say with anyone I'm speaking with, that I look for and can see the humanity in each man I experience. I love them in and for their humanity, regardless of if we agree or not, or even if I abhor their views. You know, their views come from someplace. And it's not my place to say that my views are better than your views. It's not to say that my beliefs are better than your beliefs. Because that's, I think, where we dig in, and that's where we get stuck as a nation. We get stuck as a society by digging in that my view is better than your view. When I think about spiritual understanding, what I often say is deepening our spiritual understanding means that we are on a journey to discover our own truth beyond our constructed and protective layers. Then our goal and our challenge is then to see others in their authentic truth. And then to accept both truths as true and not that one truth is better than the other truth. And that we can be in the tension of the polarity and the complexity of who we are as human beings and be in a place of acceptance. And I think that's the foundation of love, is the foundation, is the acceptance for unconditional love. That we move from loving others with conditions, that if these criteria are met, then I can love you, versus unconditional love is regardless of those criteria, I love you no matter what.
That hurts, man.
And we don't have to agree. And we can still be committed to the justice that we see and need in the world. But by getting curious and seeking to have this level of understanding, we can create a different type of dialogue and a different type of conversation across identity and across the political spectrum that allows us to go to a place of what is our shared humanity and what is our collective we. And I think that's what's missing in a lot of the discussions today, is that shared humanity piece, or to have humanity in these conversations to begin with.
Big capital H humanity.
And what I find is that no matter what man I'm speaking with, especially men in these hypermasculine systems, that the common thread is they will say to me, I find you non-threatening and I feel safe opening up to you. And so I often, I'll upset people when I say, I think that's where we need to focus. For a lot of the population that's not feeling included in the conversation, what we need to focus on is just witnessing each other, being with each other in the celebration and in the suffering, and offering hope to each other. Because I think one of the biggest epidemics facing men is the epidemic of isolation and loneliness and going it alone. And we're seeing it from the Surgeon General. Mm-hmm. We're seeing it from all of the studies. And I want to move from reading the reports and saying, yes, 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 this is a problem, to viscerally understanding what that means.
Yeah.
That the antidote to the isolation and the loneliness is connection, and the yearning is connection. And our protective layers hold us back from connection and intimacy out of fear, out of stigma, out of access, out of understanding it's possible. But if we can come back to that place of what are we doing as a community of men to create the invitation for men to come in and feel a sense of community, a sense of belonging. And when I'm in conversations and people are like, well, you know, the folks who are holding the conversation right now, the Jordan Petersons, the Ben Shapiros, the, you know, a lot of the conservative talking folks or folks who are at the pulpit, you know, what is the, you know, I listened to like the Proud Boys messaging and I'm like, what are we missing? Mm. What is taking folks to Proud Boys and not somewhere else?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What is taking men to Oath Keepers and not somewhere else? And I think it's that tribal sense of belonging. You know, they're hearing something that they can feel safe belonging to, that's speaking to something that's agitated within them, that is getting calmed by being in these communities. So what can we do on the other side of the equation that's giving a sense of community in a space that is compassionate and loving among men, that creates a type of intimacy where it's okay to talk about what's going on internally? That really gives us a space where we are celebrating each other's growth and we're there for each other in the hardships and the tests. Right?
Yeah.
It's very easy to be in a community of men where everything is externally focused.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what I think that's where men gravitate, is to a number of these different initiatives, but they're externally focused where they don't have to look at themselves for a sense of a personal accountability or a deeper level of reflection.
I want to pause there, okay, to point something else out that I see in my reading of a lot of these things, and it is around that external focus. It is around that objectification,
yeah,
of whatever it is. So yeah, I totally hear and get and resonate with the sense of belonging, that right, these men feel a sense of belonging. And there's also something that I have trouble with, which is part of that sense of belonging is engendered in a common enemy right, in quotes, out there, right? Which could be your rights as a human being.
Right.
Or, you know, the attacks on any number, the attacks on right, feminists, the attacks on liberals, the attacks on trans issues, the attack, like all of these things. So
right,
what are you learning about that as you're going into these spaces and being in these spaces?
Yeah, I think the conversation that's so hot right now is trans and non-binary.
Yeah.
And what I find is when I go into some of these communities, the over intellectualization and over rationalization to get to the right answer, or to confirmation bias, to confirm my own assertion, and without the humanity and without the compassion of like, what is the lived experience of the person that we're talking about? And so I think, you know, you're hitting it from a place of objectification and othering.
Othering, yes.
And then what I would say is the two dimensions I see are de-identification. The, you know, what we're operating in is when we talk about empathy and compassion and humanity, these are coming from the feminine energy. And so in some ways you could say that in a world that is elevating the feminine to come into balance, you know, that our trick is to the challenge and the trick and the possibility is when we can engage men around this changing, evolving world without emasculating men in the process.
Yeah.
And I think it's the combination between the emasculation that men fear, and the de-identification of, I have known this my entire life, of this is what it means to be a man, or this is what it means to be in my masculine energy, or what masculinity means, and you're totally taking that away or challenging it or distorting it, I don't know what the alternative is, and I'm afraid of the alternative.
Yeah.
So I think it's you know, a combination of probably those four dimensions: objectification, othering, fear of emasculation, and de-identification of what I've always known. And I'm sure there are others, but those are the four that come to me first, that become part of the obstacle, and it becomes easy to stay disconnected and find others where we keep it disconnected, where we don't have to see our shared humanity, or that someone else's humanity is. Because I think where we're at is, you know, with all the coaches out there, the men's groups, the, you know, self-help, we are, especially in America, we are really getting this individual consciousness thing down. Like, I'm going to come into my individual consciousness, and we verge on the shadow of it, which is the narcissism.
Narcissism, right, yeah.
Flip side of it is we haven't yet created the model, and I don't think it's emerged yet, of how do we move from individual consciousness to collective wisdom. And so how can we really come into that place of oneness and also a different level of energy together, a different level of connection together that's coming from a deeper intuitive knowing, that then we're getting out of our logical minds, and we're getting into our hearts, we're getting into our bodies, and we're connecting in a way that we see each other's shared humanity. And then we can look at our challenges in front of us in a different way.
And learning to define the terms that we use in a new way also, right? So that identification of, this is what it means to be a man, this is what masculinity is, this is what that is divorced from full humanity.
Right, exactly.
Right? So let's define masculinity as all those things, right?
Right.
Open it up so that we can embrace more of it, because that objectification of trying to define masculinity as this set of traits, right, or femininity as this set of traits, that many of us do, even in the men's workspace. I see this lots in the men's workspace, especially from that kind of right leaning angle, right? That traditional masculinity angle. Strength, drive, direction, focus, da 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 da. And with many of these things, it's just like, okay, let's talk about a woman giving birth.
Right.
Strength, direction, focus,
right,
tolerance for pain. Like, you know, it's fairly easy to debunk a lot of these things that we've been told, this is what is masculine.
Well, and I make the distinction between the constructs of masculinity and femininity that are often used to define gender role.
Good.
And are gendered, to the masculine and feminine energy within each of us that we all possess.
Yes.
Or we can call it yin and yang. We can call it active, receptive. We can call it whatever we want, but it's like we're operating on a continuum of energy. And so we've seen many women who possess strength, have power, who are decisive.
Fundamental, yeah.
And so the question is, I never define in a binary way, and I know this is a binary way of thinking about it, that one way is better than the other. There's a right or wrong. I always say, if we are out of balance in either direction, what's the cost and what's the benefit? How has it benefited our lives? And at the same time, what have we been missing out on in our lives? And I think, you know, the journey for so many men is that coming out of the womb, we had everything accessible to us, mm-hmm, right? And then as we grew up, as we were conditioned, parts of ourselves just started to like sift away. And so when we come into our humanity, what we're also doing is just reclaiming the parts of ourselves that we've denied, we've suppressed, we've rejected, we've feared, where our deepest shame exists, and going through the process to embrace all those aspects of ourselves, the good, the bad, the ugly, that make us us. And when we can come into a place of total acceptance of all parts of ourselves and reclaim those parts of ourselves, that's when we're coming into our full humanity. I think what we like to do is we like to get into mental masturbation around these terms and these concepts. And then we get so lost, and it's what guys, so often what guys do is we mentally masturbate around ideas and concepts, and we forget to have a lived experience, a visceral experience of our own humanity.
Mm-hmm.
And to see the true impact that it has on ourselves and someone else. And it's an easy way to shift away from our own suffering when we can intellectualize and over-intellectualize something, and then we're just living in this place that's still devoid of the stuff that's within us that really makes us human.
You went there, so I'm just going to name it that you went there to shadow work, the parts of ourselves that we are hiding, repressing, denying, keeping unconscious, hiding away. And I think that you also, without even noticing it, just said what, that the idea is not that I get rid of my shadow. The idea is not that I'm trying to get rid of anything. But it's to stop spending the energy repressing the acceptance of all of the things within me that I've been running from.
I think when we do our work, our men's work, our personal transformation work, our spiritual work, when we have a should in the equation, we're probably doing it wrong. When we are shoulding ourselves, I should look like this. I should get rid of this. I should be a good boy. I should be good in the eyes of others. Versus I am. And I accept what I am, all of it. That's when we start to move into a place of liberation. But as long as we are operating from a place of our shoulds, we are still constricted by a narrative that's telling us how we are supposed to be. And I believe in men, my philosophy on our work as we help other men is that we are guides in the inquiry. We're not showing the way forward. And I think men's work itself is at a crossroads of where it is established, which was established at a particular point in time of what we knew at that point in time, which we need to honor and revere and honor the men who went before us and to acknowledge that we are in very different times from how we think about men, masculinity, manhood, gender, sexuality. All of these things are becoming more and more complex, more and more nuanced. And how do we support men from where they are and help them honor who they are versus telling them who they are supposed to be?
Do you have advice for know-it-all mofos like myself out there making others wrong? That's the cutting edge of my work that I'm revealing to you, right?
Yes. Yeah. The first word that comes up is humility. My boss at Eileen Fisher always told me, Sean, in our work, you can never wrong someone because their truth is their truth. We can hold people accountable. We can hold our views without losing the integrity of our views. But when we engage with each other, it's to get curious to say, where do these views come from? What is your point of view? How are you thinking about this? versus an automatic that's wrong, because it doesn't align with how I see the world. And when we can get curious about each other's worldviews, and again, what are we operating from? Are we operating from love? If we're operating from love, that's the foundation. If we're manifesting our love through compassion, that is a different orientation. When we're holding things from a right and wrong perspective out of our intellect versus the perspective of our hearts, you know, we hold differently. We hold differently. And so I think it's the work of, for so many men, how do we learn to love in a new way? How do we learn to love and moving, like I said earlier, from that place of love with conditions to unconditional love? How do we move from into that place? And what happens when we are operating from a place of unconditional love? What is our capacity to be in acceptance? What is our movement from tolerance to appreciation?
Mm.
What is our movement from judgment to curiosity? And how and what is our goal? Is our goal to wrong someone so they come to our side? Or is our orientation to seek to understand so that we can actually engage each other in a meaningful conversation where we can really hear each other, value each other, and love each other in the process?
And in order to, thank you very much. And in order to do that, circles way back to early in the conversation, I have to slow down enough to hear from my inside, right? To hear that voice of, oh, I'm a soul trying to connect with another soul.
Right. I'm a soul trying to connect with another soul, and our souls are operating in their own journey. The challenge is many of us don't listen deep enough to what our soul is calling to us. And I think part of unconsciously why I became an interfaith minister, now as I look at it, we define so many ways that there is a brokenness among men. And I often say I don't think men are broken, but I do think men are wounded.
Wounded, yes.
Men don't necessarily have the access to the healing out of access, availability, knowing it's available, or stigma to engage in the work. But I do think a lot of men are in spiritual crisis. And by that, I mean when we are disconnected from ourselves, we're disconnected from our spirits. Many people have walked away from organized religion.
Yes.
And yet haven't replaced it with some sort of spiritual community that is just asking you to appreciate and understand the values of loving from that place of spiritual understanding.
Very well said. Define spiritual. Talk more about what is it to be spiritual? What is spirituality?
You know, in my book, I talk about deepening spiritual understanding from the lens of compassion. I define compassion through about 8 different faith traditions: Christianity, Judaism, Islam, Sufism, Buddhism, Hinduism, shamanic practice, and integral spirituality, and a little bit of Course in Miracles. And then look at the universal truths of, like, how do we define compassion? And at the root of it is just this work of love. And that's what led to the work I do around compassionate masculinity. It's a spiritually grounded way of thinking about how do we embrace our masculinity without emasculating us in the process. Or and it's a challenge to that saying that empathy and compassion are a sign of weakness, when all of these spiritual traditions say the opposite. But what I think is, in the simplest way, spirituality are our core beliefs, the combination of our core beliefs and the movement from ego to what transcends our ego to something bigger than ourselves. And so in 12-step, it's higher power. There are gods or there are deities. There's divine source. But then for the secular humanist, it's often, I believe in humanity. Mm. For those who are ecological, I believe in nature. You know, and so these, and even when I talk to my atheist friends and my agnostic friends, what I often say is, I often get what you don't believe in, but I'm curious what you do believe in. And from the place of what they do believe in, I'm like, oh, so you believe in humanity, or you believe in X, Y, and Z. You believe in Star Wars. You know, whatever it is, that is something that transcends your own ego to something bigger than you.
Mm.
And when you can find, and what I find, you know, I talk about an experience where I was sitting in a meeting with Senate staffers.
Yes.
Talking about, it was right after the Uvalde shooting, and our Project Compassion team was meeting with Durbin's folks, Senator Durbin's folks. And our 30-minute conversation revolved around men's mental health, gun violence, mass shootings, police suicides, veteran suicides, and police shootings. And for the most part, that conversation was really talking about men who move to the place of hopelessness.
Mm-hmm.
And what I always say in my work is that I don't meet men where they are, because I think that's condescending. And I think it suggests I'm in a superior place than where they are, and I'm coming down to meet them where they are. But I do say, as a man who has suffered greatly and has healed greatly, that I'm a man who is healing, who is here to help other men heal.
Mm.
And from that place, I'm not talking from the mountaintop, I'm talking from, I've been in the shit storm of life, and have survived. And that from those experiences, and from seeing this man in his humanity, even if he's in his darkness, or if he's in a dark place, that I'm here to meet men in their suffering. I'm here to listen for their yearning. And I'm here to offer hope in the midst of both. And I think the thing that's missing for so many men is that sense of hope when things get so dark or they feel so alone that they can't see the tunnel and the light at the end of the tunnel that's giving them a sense of hope. And I think that's what, you know, if that's one thing we can do in our communities of men, is just be with, listen to, and offer a sense of hope. And be in the celebration, as I said, and be with men in their darkness without being their coach.
Yeah.
Without being their savior.
Yeah.
But really just being with and being able to empathize, being able to be compassionate, and being able to say, you know, I've been there. This is my story. And where we share stories with each other. And we can find ways to offer hope to each other. You know, I think that's one of the primary and probably most basic ways we can start to break some of the cycle of some of the epidemic of loneliness that we have.
And that hope, even when intellectually I look out in the world and don't feel it, what I have experienced over and over is that simply sitting and being with a man in curiosity and openness and open-heartedness to hear a story,
right,
the sense of palpable belonging created in that space is hope, creates hope.
Right.
Yeah. In that moment of presence.
For a man to be heard by another man. And even the work we do with police, you know, we often say, we're just going to come in and just hold the space for officers from a place of love. Because right now, a lot of officers aren't feeling the love from society.
Right.
Right. And I think it's the first time probably in the history of policing where police are viewed in the way they're viewed at this point. And when we look at the humanity of these officers and why they became officers and what many are going through or struggling with, you know, and when I look at the statistics, when I look at the statistics around drug use, suicides, violence, domestic violence, it's there. It's present. And again, it's like, can I move beyond seeing this man behind his badge and what he represents to, can I see him in his humanity of what he yearns for? And so I think across the board, if we can hold men from a place of witnessing and listening without judging and fixing, that's often the first place to start.
Beautiful. I want to bring this concept in just very briefly, a book that I love, The Dawn of Everything by Graeber and Wengrow. Mm-hmm. Dawn of Everything. I've recommended it multiple times. I got a concept out of that book, Schismogenesis, the creation of culture based in opposition.
Mm.
Whole cultures have created themselves in opposition to their neighbor, right? To the tribal culture that lives next door. We're not them. We're going to set our whole foundation up. We're not them. And I think it's a useful question for me when I am confronted in that, right? We're talking about policing. We're talking about ACAB. We're in that, this moment in time. How am I setting my whole reality up based in opposition to something?
Right.
And where can I release that to see the humanity of somebody who's sitting with me? How am I attached? It's an attachment thing. Yeah.
You know, I find that one of my biggest learnings, lessons on this journey has been, how do I let go of my attachments? And how do I hold something that I would, what I would typically be viewed as in opposition of?
Mm-hmm.
From a place of non-attachment and a place of acceptance of that's reality. I see it as it is without my perception of how it should be. And I can then look at, so now where are the opportunities for bridge building? Where are the opportunities for a different type of dialogue? Where are the opportunities to talk about our disagreements in a way that doesn't lead to a blown out fight or shut down? But we can disagree and still hold each other from a place of shared humanity. And that we not that we are letting go of our views or letting go of our perspectives.
Yeah.
But that we can hold the conversation in a different way that allows the voices to be heard and we can learn from each other.
Beautiful. Beautiful. Before I wrap to when the book is coming and website and all of that kind of stuff into the last thing, I want to shout out a teacher, a guy named Tom Pittner, who is a Zen priest who I've known for a bunch of years. And he made a point of doing kind of cross-cultural, cross-spiritual tradition meditations.
Mm.
And one of the most powerful meditations that I have ever participated in, he would sit down and center and ring the bell, and today's meditation will come from the Christian tradition. And he would start by saying a verse, and I don't even know where the verse is from. Be still and know that I am God. Mm. And he would ring the bell and he would allow silence. Mm. Be still and know that I am. Ring the bell and sit in silence. Be still. Ring the bell and sit in silence. And then be. Ring the bell. And then we would sit in silence with the word be.
Hmm.
And it was one of the most profound things to take from all of that to just be.
What I have observed, experienced, witnessed is that the further we walk the spiritual path, the more we live from a place of simplicity. And that the greatest teaching can come from the simplest teachings. You know, and we often get consumed by it has to be bigger, it has to be deep, it has to be
ornate.
All these things, right?
Yeah.
And in reality, often it's the simplest gesture, the simplest experience, the you know, something that happens in passing. It's the innocuous comment that it's like, oh, that just totally landed. And so we often get so consumed by, again, what it should be. And yet there's a simplicity of it that can let go of all of that. And so your example of just cutting down those words, and with each new framing, it's taking us deeper and deeper within ourselves. And I think that's, you know, and we're becoming more sophisticated around our language around spirituality. And it's really easy to then put the sayings out there, put the quotes out there, put the motivations out there, the inspirations out there, and still not be living it in a very visceral way. And so it's sort of these empty gestures,
right,
that in our pursuit of relevance, in our pursuit of being known, being, and if we're holding any level of savior complex, you know, and as we can, again, go back to that idea of humility and just come from that place of being and sharing and curiosity, and my favorite concept is surrendering into the unknown. That I am better in the world when I am operating from the unknown and from a place of curiosity than in the known and in my knowing and in my rightness.
There we go. And I'll start with myself. All the ways that I run from it. Yes. Thank you. Sean Harvey, how can people get in touch with you, learn more about what you're doing, and get prepped to get your book?
Mm-hmm. So I think the easiest place is to go to my website, warriorcompassion.com. You can learn more about the book. You can send me a note from the website saying you want to make sure your name is on the list to pre-order, and I can send you a note to remind you when it's time that the book is coming out in the next 4 to 6 weeks. And then I will start talking about my book tour that's going to be across the country over the next probably 4 to 6 months once the book comes out. So you'll be able to, I think that's probably the easiest place to go. You can always find me on LinkedIn as well, Sean Harvey. And I'm always happy to connect and hear more of your stories, your journeys, and offer support however I can.
Sean Harvey, and that is SEANHARVEY. Sean Harvey, thank you for being here, brother. I love you.
Love you too, man. Thank you so much.
This has been the Mankind Podcast, produced in association with the Mankind Project USA. And I personally want to thank our guests for joining us today and imparting their wisdom from their experiences in this amazing journey called life. Now, the fee for this episode is simple. If you found gold and insights that you believe could benefit your loved ones and those you care about, be sure to share it with them. And of course, remember that life doesn't happen to us. It happens for us, so long as we rip the pen out of fate's hand and become the author of our own story. So my friend, pick up the pen, and we'll see you next week. Lots of love.